Hello and welcome to the One Stop English podcast. Each month we bring together teachers, editors and experts to discuss what's going on in the world of ELT. I'm your host, Sam Wadsworth, former teacher and current editor here at Macmillan. Joining me this month are Patrick Curry, Delta qualified teacher and editor on One Stop English.
Morning, Sam.
Becca Sanderson, former teacher and editor of numerous general English and business courses.
Hey, Sam.
And Ollie Wood, MA qualified teacher and teacher trainer, currently working as the academic manager at the London School in Tiene, Italy.
Hey, Sam.
This month we'll be discussing how and when to grade your language, using etymology to teach vocabulary, and activating schema. We also have an interview with Deborah Marsh, teacher, teacher trainer, online learning expert, and former head of teacher professional development at Macmillan. Okay, so Ollie, you're joining us, you're Skyping in from Italy. How's everything going over there? What do you do there?
Here in Italy, I'm working as an academic manager alongside the director of studies. So I guess that's looking at long-term objectives with the school, and as we'll be talking about a little later on, methodology that's used in the school, including flipped classroom, blended learning.
Great. And so how long have you been at that school?
Not too long, actually. It's just about a year now. Before that, I was working as a teacher trainer in Barcelona.
Okay, great. All right, let's get started. Patrick, you're going to talk about the relative merits of meticulously measured instructional discourse. Or, in other words, should we grade our language?
Yeah, okay. That's what we're going to talk about today. So I'm sure most of our listeners know all about grading language in the classroom. But if anyone is still unfamiliar, it basically means adjusting or simplifying the instructional language used in a class to suit your learners. So for lower level learners, this would mean avoiding overly complex vocabulary and grammar structures. And for higher level learners, it may mean including higher level target language in rubrics or instructions. Mm-hmm. So far, so good?
Yeah.
However, grading language doesn't only apply to spoken instructions. Broadly speaking, it can be divided into two receptive areas: what students hear and what they read. So today I wanted to have a quick chat about both areas and see if there's any kind of wiggle room from the standard L plus one rule that most teachers adhere to. And to see if the three of you have any gems of advice for our listeners. So everyone up for that?
Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. Good.
Right, so let's start with the spoken instructions. Ollie, if I can ask you, what did you learn on your initial teacher training courses and what is your approach nowadays?
To be honest, I don't think it's probably changed an awful lot. I think I probably just got better at it. It essentially was always divided into three groups, one of which being lexis and sort of colligation as well, and then speed and enunciation. So you can imagine on the initial teacher's training, I didn't really know what any of those things were, but it stuck with me. And then over the years, I've just sort of refined it and got better at it and put different emphasis depending on what level I'm teaching.
Okay. Sam, Becca?
Yeah, I think same, definitely, on my CELTA course. It was very much grade to the level of your class. But what's interesting these days, you know, I've read about people saying you just don't need to do that at all. You shouldn't.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I think a lot of the people I worked with at lower levels, obviously a beginner and elementary and that kind of thing, strongly, firmly believed still in grading their language. But actually, a lot of teachers seem to think that it's a good idea to grade up your language for higher level classes because otherwise you're presenting an inauthentic model for students to copy. What do you think about that, Ollie? Is that a fair point?
Yes, totally agree. Certainly at the lower levels, you know, if you went in there and spoke authentic English, whatever that may be, they'd be blown away. They wouldn't understand anything.
Right.
But yeah, later on, why not? I think it depends a lot on what the students want. If they're aiming to pass a certain exam, then maybe you just talking away is going to get in the way of their goal. Hmm. But if it's somebody whose objective is to become fluent in English because they want to travel abroad, live abroad, work abroad, then yeah, they need as much exposure to real English as possible. And course books won't provide that.
Okay, so if we accept then that we should probably grade our language depending on the level, Patrick, what sort of things should we avoid?
Well, I think things like phrasal verbs, they can't usually be understood from constituent parts.
Right, so the same with idioms, presumably then.
Yeah, I think you can teach them, obviously, but don't just throw them into the instructions in the classroom language. I mean, the issue with grading your language too much is that you give students a false sense of their level. So they'll go out of the classroom thinking they understand everything, but then they'll hit the street and realise they actually don't. But, conversely, you shouldn't really throw in phrasal verbs and things like idioms, as you say, which are, they're not easy for students to, they can't be translated directly.
Yeah, basically an instruction should be short and sweet. It shouldn't take over the lesson, so...
I mean, and that's true of any instruction in life, isn't it? If we're trying to instruct someone to do something, it has to be clear and succinct.
Yeah, I mean, I think keeping in mind things like just be direct and use gesture as well. Ollie, anything else?
Yes, certainly something that I've always tried to keep in mind is the fewer than five rule. Literally counting on my fingers the instructions that I'm giving. If I'm going past five, I'm talking too much. Keep it reduced.
That's interesting. Oh, yeah, I've never heard that. It's a good rule of thumb.
Absolutely. I think being aware when you're planning your class of how many instructions you're going to use for each step of the class is obviously very important. So the other part of this was not spoken, but grading your materials or grading your rubrics. So obviously a lot of teachers like to create their own materials for class, and obviously important to grade the language appropriately in that case. I researched this. I found a couple of useful tools. One site was called Readable, which rates your texts based on things like the number of passive structures used and the number of words over four syllables. And another site called the English Profile Text Inspector. And this is backed by the British Council, English UK. And it breaks text down into words in relation to their CEFR framework. And we'll put links to those two sites on the podcast. Have any of you guys used any of these sites?
So to use those for grading the text itself?
So you'd take a text, maybe if you wanted to take an authentic text from a newspaper, and then you would copy and paste that text into one of these text inspectors.
Yeah, I mean, we use that a lot for, looking at manuscripts in-house here and checking that everything's on level. So, yeah, that'd be really useful, making your own materials in the classroom.
Ollie, what about you? Have you used any of these text inspector type sites?
Yeah, the English Profile one, but I hadn't used it to look at an entire text before. Now, I'd done it to look at individual words, particularly if one word had multiple uses, right, to see where it fell on the scale. So in fact, I did it for the first time recently, putting a whole text in there, and didn't get the result I thought I was going to get.
Right.
This was something I had written as part of my Delta, so a while back, but I thought, this would be a good test. Copy, paste, put it in. It turned out the majority of what I was doing was A2.
And what did you want it to be?
Well, I just assumed it would be a little bit higher.
Okay,
because I was writing kind of an academic style piece for another native speaker. So I was kind of surprised at the level of language that was generally used in the text.
Yeah, I mean, a few things about that. I think the text inspector, certainly the one that I've used, just looks at individual words. So it doesn't look at structure. It doesn't look at sentences as a whole. So it might not be able to detect that. But also, actually, I don't know, I work a lot on academic manuscripts. And if you read articles in things like Scientific American and things like that, they are actually really simple. The language itself and the structures are quite simple because they're trying to explain complex problems. It's just that they use very specific vocabulary or high-level noun phrases, that kind of thing. So it's an interesting one. I think it's a useful tool, but you need to sort of use it with caution, I guess.
Absolutely. I did test this, and Ollie and I communicated prior to recording the podcast by email. So I put our text from the email into the English Profile Text Inspector.
Did you know this? Were you aware of this, Ollie? That he's grading your emails?
No, I'm intrigued
emails.
Well, this is when I'm not trying.
No, well, it came out as 96%, which would put our communications at a low intermediate bracket. I then popped in a paragraph of an article from the Guardian newspaper, and that came in at 77%, making it suitable only for advanced learners, showing us definitively that the Guardian has a far more complex level of vocabulary than myself and Ollie.
Nice.
Right. Something to think about there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Food for thought. So I actually did a little bit of research on this as well. I posted a question on Facebook and a couple of Facebook pages for about ELT and got some good responses. Donald Fogarty, a pod listener and teacher in Colombia, made the point that communication and choice of words could well be related to intercultural context and not just language level. Any thoughts on that?
I think that's an interesting one. But on the other hand, if you think something like a cartoon, that doesn't really have a grade language and it's sort of set for a particular context, particular cultural context as well. Not something I'd thought of, to be honest.
Yeah.
We had a couple of other responses as well. We had Grace Dalio Alvarez from Argentina said that language should be graded depending on the age and level, as this helps build students' confidence and they can therefore follow the class and understand the teacher. Mm-hmm. And Steve Hershorn from Parts Unknown, he mentioned the bog standard L1 rule. So, interestingly, Donald Fogarty, actually, he has a blog and he's reviewed the podcast on his blog.
Okay.
Yeah, very, very nice review indeed. So, anyone want to read the review? We'll put a link on the page as well.
Thanks, okay. Donald.
So anyway, the general gist is that successful communication, or communicators rather, always grade their language, whatever the context, I think. That goes outside the classroom with friends and family. But with regards to teaching, most people agree that you've got to grade your language in the classroom, and spending time to getting to know your learners is very important, and knowing whether they can handle more authentic speech.
Very interesting. All right. Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Okay, so our next story centres around one question. Does knowing the etymology of a word actually help understanding? To try and answer this, Becca has been talking to native speakers at Macmillan about the origins of some common vocabulary.
Where do you think the expression caught red-handed comes from?
Makes me think of how they put the dye on the clothes in shops, so if you steal it, it explodes and then you get dye on your hands, so then they know.
Maybe something like stealing bread out of an oven, and they got caught whilst their hand was in the oven.
All right, next one. How about know the ropes?
Is that a sailing term?
Ships, boats, sea, faring.
So where are we going to find ropes? On a boat? Sailors?
Yeah.
The Navy?
Yes.
Maybe like in a church with the church bells or something. Yeah. There's the rope.
Next one, mad as a hatter.
That's going to be Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, is that from Alice in Wonderland?
From Lewis Carroll.
Something to do with, like, clowns and hats.
Like, someone who makes hats, so they tend to be a bit out there.
Does it have to do with milliners?
Yeah.
Did they go crazy from all of the intricate work?
Okay, next one, loophole.
Something like material or knitting or weaving.
If you think of knitting or sewing.
Uh-huh.
Or some kind of fabric. There's a little hole, things can get through it.
Okay, last one is a bigwig.
Law, perhaps,
uh-huh.
As in, like, the very important people have those wigs, and so they're the bigwigs.
Is that something political? Is that from the wigs, as in...
It is to do with wigs.
Tories, wigs. So was it a prime minister, or name from the leader of the Whig party?
Is it from the times when everyone wore powdered wigs? And the bigger the wig, the more important you were?
Maybe aristocrats, a landed gentry back in the day, the bigger your wig, the more important you were.
The Bee Gees.
That's it.
You did pretty well.
Loads of ideas there. We don't need to go through what everything does mean, but you can look that up if you need to know. But I think what's interesting in that is that you can hear them all kind of running through connections to try and figure out the meanings, and I guess that's what etymology is all about. So what are some of the reasons why we should bring etymology into the classroom?
Well, I was thinking about this, and actually a lot of books do teach the meanings of prefixes or suffixes, and that can be fairly useful. You know,
right.
the adding able to something means that you are able to do it. It becomes, an adjective?
Yes, or like re, anything with re is sort of usually again. So, yeah, I think on a sort of superficial level, that's definitely always there in course books.
Yeah, Ollie, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, for prefixes, suffixes, absolutely. But what we were looking at are things like idioms.
Mm.
It's more useful perhaps for creating a class discussion. If it were looking at the meaning to learn the word, I don't know, my impression would be a lot of time could get lost in going through that process.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think for teachers it's very, very interesting because lots of teachers are kind of linguists. That's why they become teachers in the first place. But yeah, you're right, with students maybe... teachers might assume an interest on the part of the student that isn't there. So you've got to be very careful with this.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I guess this is what you were sort of suggesting, Ollie, is that this is just not the most direct way for them to understand how some words are used. You know, like, say, breakfast. My parents always like to harp on about how that's a break in your fast. But knowing that as a student really doesn't seem as useful as just, oh, this is the meal that you have at the beginning of the day, right? It just seems like a much longer way of getting to the point.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the things when I was reading about this, it's mainly directed to intermediate advanced learners. It's something that you'd bring in at that kind of level. But I think you can start to make those connections earlier on. I kept coming across this term when I was reading up on it, this term meaningful learning, which is a kind of learning related to prior learning. So yeah, it's about making connections, and if you have this background knowledge of words and how they're formed, it's going to be a lot easier to take on and absorb new language, you know, not necessarily expressions, but vocabulary. You know, you've got this hook where you can hang things. Yeah, I watched a couple of really nice TED-Ed talks by linguist Gina Cook, and we can put them in the show notes. But she looks at the meaning and structure of words, which can also sometimes help to solve those mysteries of bizarre English spelling. You know, like, why is there a B in the word doubt, for example? Mm. You know, it's all about its Latin origin. But yeah, if you're making these back-end connections, it's a much stronger foundation than, you know, like learning by rote or looking at your list of words in your notebook and just trying to commit them to memory. It's hard. But I think one of the problems with etymology, specifically with English etymology, is that the connections for us aren't as clear as in some other languages. So I was looking at Japanese characters, for example. So the character for tree also features in the characters for forest or woodworker. Again, the character for hand also appears in the character for hold and strike. So it's really visual and a lot easier to make the connections. Even if you don't know the full word, you can make an educated guess and, you know, roughly understand what we're talking about. I mean, I think we do that anyway to a certain degree. It's just not as transparent. And for example, I recently met a student, Hiroshi, who was visiting from Japan. Hello, Hiroshi. And we were talking about this topic and he was like, oh yeah, so what about that expression to pull the wool over someone's eyes? Where does that come from?
Oh,
no idea.
So what does it mean?
To deceive someone.
To deceive someone, yeah. But we looked it up and we went round the houses and it's, I mean, there's always several explanations for these things, but there was one about the time when people wore wigs and maybe if you wanted to mug someone, you'd pull their wig to confuse them, pull their wig down. Or something else was talking about judges and they wore wigs or they wear wigs. And if a lawyer happens to trick the judge, then perhaps that's what he's done. He's pulled the wool over his eyes. But it took us ages to get to that.
Yeah,
it's
and
really
actually,
time consuming.
I don't know, this taps into what I was just thinking is one of the big problems of this, really, is that words, the English language is organic, right? So the meaning of words or the way that we use words changes over time and becomes something different to its origin. So this is something that actually really annoys my dad. He thinks everything should be the original meaning, but that's just not how it works, right? Things change over time. So in many instances, this would only work if the etymology had remained the same, or at least the way that we use the word had remained the same over time.
Yeah, I mean, if you track it, it does change. And so, yeah, you perhaps need to know about those changes as well. So that's a whole other layer of understanding for the teacher. I mean, Ollie, you mentioned before it's quite time consuming. Do you think there's any other potential problems with trying to incorporate this into your classes?
Problems with incorporating etymology?
Yeah.
I mean, I think we mentioned just a moment ago, you are assuming the students are interested in it.
Yeah, that is true.
As Patrick was saying, it's more maybe more fun for a teacher. Mm. A teacher is already naturally interested in the language, but really if a student is only interested in being able to conduct a business meeting or pass an exam or graduate university, they're likely going to see that as a waste of their time.
Yeah, I think there are some ways to encourage more meaningful learning in the classroom. For example, the use of dictionaries in the classroom, perhaps. Perhaps there's no, you don't have direct translation dictionaries. You use a second language learner dictionary. And that's kind of forcing their hand a little bit. Do you think there's any other ways we could encourage it?
Yeah, I mean, so we're always, or teachers are always looking for ways to, for students to guess the meaning of word from context.
Yes.
And often that's, you know, based on the part of speech or kind of what it looks like, if it looks like a word in their language or something like that. But maybe this is just another tool for helping them do that if they know that the root in there looks like something else or then they could guess, they could speculate over the meaning a bit better.
Yeah. I think if anyone is learning a second language, there is kind of an inherent interest in the language at some level. Mm. And so maybe you're not going to talk about full phrases, but you might get them to look at word families. And so then they'll start to notice patterns and that can speed up their learning somewhat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the way to go. I think the whole premise makes complete sense.
Yeah, so I mean, taking that point and going back to the dictionary, L1 dictionary or an L1 to L2, surely if you're looking at etymology, that might not be a bad thing. as long as the usage is controlled, you say, well, does this link to something in your language? Because if it does and they can see that, then it's much easier to learn than if there's no connection whatsoever.
Yeah, so just going back to Hiroshi when we were talking about it, he did, I'm going to quote him now, he said, we tend to find things attractive when stories are involved. So there is a lot to be said for something just being interesting.
Fair point, yeah. Great, thank you, Becca. So, listeners, over to you. What are your thoughts on grading? Do you ever use etymology to teach vocab? Email your comments to onestoppodcast@springernature.com. Okay, next up, it's Warmer of the Month. Each month, we challenge our guest teacher to explain a fun, communicative activity in no more than 5 steps. So, Ollie, over to you.
Okay, this is suffix tennis. I'm not sure where or when I picked this up, but essentially it goes like this. This would obviously be a kind of higher level class, and hopefully the students have already had some exposure to either prefixes or suffixes. So, class are in two groups, divided like a tennis court.
Then okay, so should we do that now? So, Patrick versus Becca, and I'll just be a spectator.
You can be the umpire.
Yeah.
So, there you go, two groups. Then the teacher throws out a suffix, either prefix or suffix, doesn't matter. And then the idea is that, say, Patrick is serving, so then he has to take that suffix, attach it to a word, send it over to Becca, who then takes a different word, keeps the same suffix, and knocks it back.
Okay.
Oh. And so on. And as soon as somebody trips up, the point goes to the other one, just like in tennis. And you could even score it like in tennis.
Well, let's do that right now. I will score it. I can be an umpire.
Yeah. Okay.
If I can remember how to score in tennis, I'll try. Okay, so Patrick to serve. Ollie, if you want to throw out that ball.
So, pre.
Preamble.
Present.
Can I challenge that?
I don't know.
That's not one, is it?
Well, the umpire could challenge this.
I'm happy. I'll let it slide.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Prefix.
Pretty generous.
Prefix.
I think that's 15. 15 love to Patrick.
That's really hard.
Okay, Patrick to serve again.
Less.
Careless.
Thoughtless.
Useless.
Thankless.
Heartless.
Oh, I think that's 30 love.
Okay, I don't think we can necessarily need to go through an entire game here. We go through like three sets.
Great idea.
And it's too tense.
So is there any way, how do you develop this into a class? Do you make them use these in sentences or what's a way to sort of build on this?
It depends on sort of when I'm bringing this out as a warmer. It could be a nice way to reintroduce students to the idea. So maybe you've gone through the old ones they've known from a previous level, and then towards the end of this tennis match, you can maybe throw in a new one, see what they can do with it. But absolutely, it could be used for revision.
Great.
Brilliant. That's the first time I've ever won a point for saying heartless.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, brilliant. Thank you very much. Now it's time for Word of the Month. Each month, we discuss a piece of ELT jargon and how it affects teachers. So, Patrick, what can you tell us about activating schema?
This is it's not that far removed from what Becca was talking about earlier about meaningful learning. It's kind of ELT jargon for making sure your students are ready to be engaged in the lesson from the very beginning of the lesson. So, schema theory states that for the vast majority of people, knowledge is organized into units in their brains, if they have brains, and that the teacher needs to tap into these units in order to make the lesson more engaging for students. And the theory goes that by accessing the individual's prior knowledge of a topic, that individual will be able to recreate an experience which will enable new information to be associated with that which is already known. And once it is associated with prior experience, it will immediately become more memorable. Hmm. Makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
It can be applied to all skills, but mainly gets applied to reading lessons. So an example might be if you're doing a reading lesson about being served in a restaurant, before jumping into the reading activity, you might ask the students some questions to engage them in the activity. So what type of questions might you ask them?
Have you ever had bad service in a restaurant?
How did you feel?
And I guess how did you handle that problem?
Absolutely. Okay. And so that's one way is asking questions to your students to get them interested in the topic. Do you know any other ways of activating schema?
I mean, the classic is showing a picture, right, and using that as a springboard for some kind of discussion on the topic.
I like it if it's a reading, like taking a quote, pulling a quote out of the reading and honing in on that, because you'll bring up a lot of the language, I think, in that discussion.
Ollie, what about you? What do you do?
I'm a big fan of sound effects. So like in a film or a TV show, to bring you in, it's always the sound. So if you try and watch a horror film on silent, it's just boring.
Right.
So it's all about the sound effects. So the same thing for a lesson. And they're very easy to find on YouTube now and just get it on. As the students are coming in, it creates interest quite naturally.
Yeah.
No language is involved and they'll start talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, the teacher can easily prod them and go, what do you think is going on? Mm-hmm. What does this remind you of?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, good. Okay. I mean, you've got also kind of, realia as well, bringing in objects,
yes.
Have a bag full of objects.
A quiz on the topic.
Yeah, just to get their brains working on the topic. So all of these fall under kind of the umbrella of a lead-in or warmer, but I think it's pretty much a key part of the lesson because you want to ready your students, don't just dive straight into a reading activity without them having any kind of association. But there can be some problems with activating schema, Sam?
Well, you have to choose something that you think the majority of them will actually have background knowledge of. You can't ask them to discuss something they don't know anything about.
Mm. Yeah.
So if it's a very specific engineering topic, for example, then very few of them will be able to talk about that.
Yeah.
Any other problems?
I know there could be cultural problems as well. If you've got a mix of cultures in a room, some people identify with things one way. Someone from another country will identify it another way. You might not arrive at the same point, the one the teacher wants them to.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, and I think time is an issue as well. Sometimes these lead-ins sometimes go on a bit and everyone's looking at their watch thinking, when are we actually going to start?
Right.
So you need to sort of manage those expectations of the lesson.
Yeah, if you have like a 60-minute class and then you spend 20 minutes trying to activate schema, and students obviously, some do enjoy it, but then, like you say, others will think, well, what are we actually learning here?
Mm. Yeah.
So anyway, that's your word of the month.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Okay, let's move on to this month's interview. This month, Patrick is talking to Deborah Marsh about teacher professional development, blended learning, and course design.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Hi, Patrick.
Excellent. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So to begin with, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your career?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been in English language teaching for many, many years. Not that I'm going to tell you how many years. People can work that out for themselves. And when people ask me, what do? I think really at heart, I am a teacher. I'm an English language teacher, despite the fact that I've had many different roles and worked for many different people. I started teaching in France. I then went on to teach in Cairo for International House. And then I went back to the UK, where I went to the University of Hull as head of English language teaching. But from there, it was then that I started moving into online learning and blended learning and all things to do with the sort of technology and technology supported.
Mm.
But for anybody who knows me, I'm really not the techie. That's not what my interest is. My real interest is the whole teaching and learning of English and language. Then just recently, I actually went back and did some teaching. And quite an experience that was too.
Excellent. Okay, where was that?
Here in France. As you know, as many people know, I live in France. My husband is head of English language teaching at the university here, and he needed somebody desperately to fill in, so I put my hand up and said, yeah, I'll do it. yes. The first class was a very interesting one, practicing what I preach.
Excellent. So you worked at McMillan quite recently, and as you were the head of the Teacher Professional Development Department.
Yep.
In that department, which areas of professional development did you feel are kind of overlooked and in need of more attention these days?
Well, I just think the whole focus of professional development for teachers at the moment has shifted so far towards the use of digital and use of technology that we're clearly overlooking what I would call the fundamental basics. Because whichever way we look at it, a teacher still needs to work with the students face-to-face, so there's a lot of time in the classroom. And I don't think we're really looking at what I would call sort of the very basics of teaching, lesson planning, classroom management, error correction, learner feedback. And it's all about what the technology does and, to be frank, just pushing the buttons. And I think at my time at Macmillan, that was a lot of the work we were doing, is thinking through how we could support those very basics, while at the same time not obviously disregarding the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Mm, so paying attention basically to the kind of nuts and bolts
of
teaching. But yeah, technology is obviously a big thing in teaching these days, obviously from a publishing point of view and increasingly from a classroom point of view. And last year you gave a presentation at IATEFL on blended learning. Can you talk a little bit about that and tell us the what, if anything, has changed since you gave that talk?
Yep. I don't think anything's changed since last year. I think we've been talking about blended learning, integrated learning for many, many years now. I think what is changing is the understanding that we can't disregard what's happening in the classrooms. Mm. And we need to think about a lot more about how the technology is supporting the activity there rather than trying to replace it. I think we've all spent time thinking through how can we replace what happens in the classroom, and that was just not the right way of thinking about it. We need to think how it can support that. And I think there's a general shift towards that focus now, but I think there's still a lot more discussion to be had and research to be done, really.
Mm, okay. And now another part of your expertise is course design and development. So for any budding writers out there or who are teachers who want to become writers and want to get into course design, what do you think are the most important things for them to know?
I think for many of us, when we're teachers, we're quite used to that sort of whole design development area because we do that on a daily basis. We do that in our classrooms. No matter how many published materials we have and how good they are, we all do that design and development. And then again, we think, well, then a natural next step in our career would be that course design development. I think one of the mistakes, and I certainly made it myself when I started out, was that you tend to design and develop what you like to work with and what your particular students like to work with. And I soon learned that there's just no one way to design and develop courses. And I think the most important thing is, if that's the move you want to make, if that's what you want to do, is to start listening and talking to and observing what other teachers do, what other students want, and really having as wide a view of the opportunities before you start putting, you know, a pen to paper, start clicking on the keyboard and designing that course. And then when you've done that course, is to make sure that you also talk to people again, that they have that understanding of what was to be achieved. I think that's probably the biggest lesson I learned. I went in with my usual enthusiasm many years ago, and I wrote a course that I thought was the best course in the world. Yeah, it was if I was going to be the teacher teaching it. It wasn't necessarily exactly what would work for somebody else. So I think that's what I would certainly advise.
Okay, so kind of a broader focus. But finding a specialism as well, because obviously a lot of teachers, you draw upon your experience when you're writing. And nowadays, I suppose, looking for the new big thing or the next niche, people talk a lot about flipped classroom.
Yes.
I mean, we talked about blended learning, but with flipped classroom, you've done some work there. What would you advise teachers who want to look at flipping their classroom and implementing that methodology? Is there a way you can incorporate that into your writing, or is it more of just a way of teaching?
I think the talk around the flipped classroom is important, and I think it's very interesting for language learning. I would personally advocate that the starting point for flipped learning is the classroom, is asking yourself, what are you trying to achieve in the classroom? And in the work that I've done over the years and talking to teachers, most of the time a teacher will respond and say, what I want to do with my students, I really want them to use the language and to communicate. So that's your starting point. And then build out and say, okay, if I want to use most of my classroom time for communication, what do I need my students to do outside of the classroom in order for that to be successful? And I think a lot of it is down to the planning. It takes a lot of planning, flipped learning, because at the moment we don't have those lesson plans and those course books and the course design which supports a fully flipped approach. So, yeah, that's my starting point, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because I suppose some teachers would feel that the flipped approach might threaten their way of teaching because they're used to giving the presentations in class, whereas the flipped classroom, you'd take those presentations and they would be the student would see them before class.
I mean, that's the premise of the flipped classroom. But again, I wouldn't say we have to put all the presentation out of the classroom. It may mean that you don't spend as much time in class doing that. I think for teachers starting out, simply saying, right, no more presentation and practice in class, 100% communication, 100% interaction can be very, very daunting. And I tried that myself with my own students, and they weren't prepared for it. They really weren't prepared to do that. So I soon changed the structure of what I would call the structure of my lesson. And some of the presentation was outside, but I didn't have to spend so long at the beginning of the classroom introducing the new language. That's what I did at the beginning, and then slowly move away from the reliance on that and in the classroom. And again, it's something that I think as an individual teacher, you need to work through depending on your students and the content, and depending also on what you have available for them to do outside of the classroom.
Sure. So it's kind of a gradual process, getting your students used to it as well as getting used to it yourself.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to move on to something else you've done, which was you work or have worked as an e-learning consultant. So what can you tell listeners about careers in an e-learning environment? What are the biggest do's and don'ts?
Many years ago, the careers in e-learning were very much focused around technology. What is increasingly the demand, increasing demand is for what I'm looking at and doing at the moment, which is learning design. And in that, you need a strong pedagogical background, a very strong understanding of different approaches in terms of language learning and language acquisition, and then being able to work that through and how that applies in an e-learning environment. Learning design looks at the holistic picture. It's looking at how you design a course, where the teacher's role is, what the students are doing at any one time, thinking through beyond just the content on screen. So it's not as much the instructional designer is looking at that. And I think teachers are well placed to do that, but they need to be able to think that through beyond what is obviously on their screen, the content. That's what I would do as a do. And as a don't is not get caught up with a particular technology or get caught up in the technology. Be very focused on the pedagogy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And finally, I wanted to ask you about a book that you co-authored, The Handbook of Online Education. So for teachers who are interested in getting into online education, how does that differ from e-learning? And what advice does the book offer for teachers?
Yeah, this is quite an old book now. When we wrote the book, my colleague Shirley Bennett, who co-authored it with me, is the main co-author, we had already been teaching online for about 4 years by then. It was very much a new area for us, but the University of Hull at the time was quite advanced in its thinking, and we had been teaching English online for about 4 years. And what we realized is that there were no resources at the time, not necessarily for course design, but for getting your students online, how to support forums, how to support interaction, how to make that online experience as personal as possible. And so that was the advice we were giving. And I think for teachers who are interested in moving into online education, the resource, there's a lot of resources out there. I would certainly recommend going to the resources and seeing what the advice is. But in fact, the best thing they can do is to do an online course themselves. Mm. Something that they're not familiar with. There's lots of free courses out there, free MOOCs even. It certainly gives you the experience of being an online learner and makes you realize just what the challenges are for the individual who's trying to learn on their own at a distance with or without a virtual teacher.
Mm, brilliant. So basically you're putting yourself in a student's shoes, learning by doing, and then applying what you learn to your own experience in the classroom. Brilliant. Okay.
Yeah. I regularly sign up for MOOCs and regularly start them and then drop out and constantly asking myself, why am I dropping out? Mm. I can find 100 excuses. But, if you have a class, you have to work that out. Why are your students not there?
Absolutely. Well, that's fantastic advice. Thanks very much. And it's been really, really fascinating talking to you.
Yes, and thanks for inviting me for the podcast. Been good talking to you too.
My pleasure. And take care and best of luck with 2017.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, so one of the things Deborah mentioned in the interview was flipped learning. And although it's a term we use a lot in publishing these days, I'm sure there are a fair few teachers out there that are unfamiliar with the concept. Fortunately, our guest teacher this month actually uses a flipped approach in his classes. So, Ollie, could you tell us a little bit about it? What makes your classroom flipped, and how does this method benefit your students?
Okay, I think to start, it's probably best to sort of define what flipped is. And in fact, flipped classroom is a model that comes from blended learning. Blended learning being an education program that combines online digital media with a traditional classroom method. And the main difference is what would traditionally be in the homework is done in class and what's traditionally done in class is given for homework. So that's the flip. The advantage of this for students is that essentially they can work at their own pace. So normally a class is time-based. The teacher's got 60 minutes, 90 minutes. The students get all the material, they're all tested, and they all move on at the same time. With a blended approach, the students can take their time, either more time or less time as they need, depending on their level of knowledge. And then the student moves on when they're ready, meaning they complete their study and come to class.
Right. And just as a sort of to play devil's advocate, have you ever had any problems with people just not doing their homework, essentially not learning that grammar point and coming in and then you say, oh, okay, great, well, we can't do that communicative activity because I now have to teach the present perfect.
Yes.
Right.
But the students learn very quickly that when you're running a flipped classroom for a whole course, and in the school where I'm working, every single course is flipped. They know that if they haven't done the prior work, they can't contribute to the lesson. So it does make them more responsible for their learning. So the problems tend to be, of course, with younger students, teenagers, who claim they didn't have the time. But as soon as they realize they're missing the fun part of a lesson, they're missing the communicative aspect of a lesson, the real English, it doesn't take long before they realize, okay, I need to put the work in and then I can get the benefits at the end of it.
So really it's about getting them to understand that this is how the class works.
This is the norm,
and they'll soon get used to it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we mentioned earlier on about meaningful learning. I do think this comes into the flipped classroom as well. If a student is interested in etymology, then it's there for them. They can go and research it. On the online platform, I can put in a link. If you're interested in this, this satisfies your curiosity, off you go. And then if they want to bring that into the classroom later, so be it. They're not interested, they can skip over it, as long as they're covering the core points that I need them to get through before the next lesson.
Brilliant, thank you. Okay, next up is teacher tips. Each month we probe our guest teacher for professional advice. So, Ollie, what are your top tips?
I really have one top tip, and that is listen to your students and cater to emerging aims. That's my top tip.
And actually, I think that sort of segues quite well into one of our Q&As this month. So if we move on to a Q&A, where we try to answer your questions, question number one is actually, which should be prioritised, achieving the lesson aims or achieving students' emerging aims?
Can you strike a balance?
So what do you think, Ollie?
So I think it depends why the student is studying. Most students won't derail their own learning. Mm-hmm. So if there's an emerging aim, it's likely because they want to address it because they think it will help their learning. And so that should feed into your lesson aims as a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you've also got to look at the context of what you're teaching, because some schools they get there's a requirement for a certain amount of a book to be taught per lesson or per day or per week. Mm. And if you don't teach the lesson aims, then you could get in a bit of trouble.
Right,
which,
you've got to check it off.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's right. Personally, I agree with Ollie that emergent aims should definitely be catered to, as long as they're not going too far off piste.
Yeah, and it's about the balance of the class, isn't it? Maybe some students want to go in one direction, but the others don't. So you have to sort of dilute things a bit, which is unfortunate, but that is how it works in the classroom when you've got 20 students.
And yeah, that's what I was going to say, actually, does it not depend on whether that aim is actually beneficial for the class as a whole or the majority of the students in the class? You know, if it's just a really interesting thing, but it's only really useful for one or two students, then perhaps it's not as relevant as the broad class aim that you've prepared. Ollie, what do you think about that?
I think that's exactly where the flipped classroom would come in. Because then you go, well, that's fantastic. Go and look it up. Bring it back to us next time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one other thing I should mention on this is that a lot of places I worked, we had one-to-one tutorials after class or once a week or once every couple of weeks. And those would be places where you could deal with students' questions if they didn't pertain to the whole class. So, yeah, I think striking a balance between the lesson aims and immersion aims is it comes with experience, but it's up to the individual teacher.
Yeah, communicate with your students, find out what, you know, if they're happy with everything.
Great.
Absolutely.
Okay, and one more question this month. what would you like to experiment with in your teaching practice? Something you've never had the courage or insanity for. Ollie, what do you think?
Yeah, I remember reading a while back about Sudbury schools. These are schools where the students have a say in absolutely everything. And I've always thought it'd be very interesting to run a whole course like that. So there is no course program. There's no syllabus. The students are all the same level, and they decide what they're going to learn and how they're going to learn. I like it in theory, but never had the wherewithal to go through with it.
Interesting. Anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that I didn't experiment with. I did it once, and I wish I'd done it a bit more. I went to work one time when I'd actually lost my voice, and so I wasn't able to speak. And so I didn't speak for an entire class, and the students did all the speaking. They didn't believe me, actually. They thought it was a game. It probably benefited them greatly, but it was interesting. And I used a lot of gesture, and I wrote a few instructions on the board. But I wish I'd done that a bit more, actually, because I think it would be useful for students not to hear me, but to speak themselves.
Yeah, and something actually I always wanted to do and didn't really do was just taking them out of the classroom much more. You know, if instead of learning functional language about how to order a coffee in class with role plays, let's just go to a coffee shop. Let's just go to somewhere and have them order coffee. It seems like it would be much more authentic and useful.
But of course, me over here in Italy, it's kind of difficult to make that happen.
True, yeah, fair point, yeah. Well, that's it for another month. If you have any questions, suggestions or feedback, or you just want to tell us how much you enjoy the show, please email us at onestoppodcast@springernature.com or leave a comment on the One Stop page. Thank you to our in-house panellists this month, Patrick and Becca.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Ollie, for joining us all the way from Italy.
Pleasure.
And thank you for listening. And until next month, this is the One Stop English Podcast.